I'd like to talk now about the hindrances, which are probably five things, which really are probably seven things, really, in a Buddhist list in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And the general heading here is a strategy of continually examining all aspects of experience to see whether a self can be found there, whether an intact, unified, independent, enduring, causelessly arising being can be found anywhere at all. And in addition to the benefits, in terms of seeing through anatta, seeing into anatta, which is selflessness, essentially, in addition to seeing into the, into the benefits of seeing into anatta, by discerning the absence of self in the hindrances is a direct and powerful way to reduce upsets, to feel less hindered and to feel less aggravated, restless, remorseful, anxious, and so forth. So, to the topic. First, what is a hindrance? It's something that hinders you. So it is seen as something that hinders progress in meditation, that hinders us in life. Interestingly, one of the benefits that's noted for concentration practices is that, particularly as we tip into deep states of absorption, the hindrances are temporarily banished, giving us a taste of a liberated mind, an unhindered, unencumbered mind. So that's a way of framing the benefits of reducing even temporarily and ultimately permanently uprooting the hindrances. So what are the hindrances? The first one is greed, which is broadly defined to include large forms of greed and small forms of I want this, more of that, I want to keep this, got to have it, etc. A certain quality of greed, which is the marker, I think, of the tipping from liking to wanting, which is the problematic move, or yellow flag at a minimum move in the mind. The giveaway there is the feeling of insistence. It's a great marker for greed. It is a kind of imperative or insisting or adamancy in the mind. Must. Gotta. Then there's hatred. Hatred, broadly defined, is sort of the other valence of wanting. Wanting not. In other words, resisting or pushing away, fearing or fighting, fleeing, all that is a form of hatred. Freezing and appeasing are forms of hatred. Anxiety is in the hatred category. Any form of aversion. And again, you can watch the tipping point from not liking to wanting not. Has again this sort of insistent, adamant, must, getting organized around this quality. Hatred, second hindrance. Third hatred is, got a great title, sloth and torpor. Sloth being laziness, indolence, like a sloth, just goofing off, not being productive, and torpor, sleepiness, etc. Maybe it's merely coincidental that after some of these kind of high-carb lunches around this joint, half the room, me included occasionally, is swirling in torpor. like a lizard on a warm rock. There might be some gratification in torpor, but it doesn't really further the path of awakening, right? So that's torpor. Okay. And And then there is restlessness and remorse. That's a very interesting one. Restlessness has to do with being fidgety. Again, what are hindrances to practice, particularly meditative and monastic practice? So being restless, being fidgety, not being able to settle. Often what breeds restlessness is some kind of agitation in the mind, often based on anxiety, worrying about something, unsettled, disturbed. And remorse has to do with shame or guilt, feeling bad, feeling inadequate, feeling tainted or spoiled, damaged goods. Those are all variations of, I think, remorse, father to find. That too is a hindrance to practice. Your mental preoccupations, they preoccupy the mind, they reduce our energy. It's hard to focus when we're caught up in remorse, or it's definitely hard to focus when we're restless and the mind is jumpy. That's a hindrance. But then the fifth hindrance, sometimes seen as the worst one of all, is doubt. And doubt here is not seen as what in Zen is called great doubt, or a kind of fundamental skepticism and thoughtfulness about things. Don't know mine. That's good. But doubt as in a continuing sort of questioning of oneself, second-guessing, Monday morning quarterbacking is the American phrase. I don't know what the equivalent would be here, but, you know, where after the game is over, you just keep thinking over and over again, should I have done that? Or maybe you know something to be true. You have an insight in meditation. But then later on you think, is that really true? Or doubt of one's own worth. That's a big form of doubt. Doubting one's goodness, doubting one's purity, doubting one's innocence, doubting the goodness in the heart of everyone, doubting that. You may know the Western philosophical phrase, you know, I think, therefore I am, cogito ergo sum. The origin of that, interestingly, is that Descartes was examining various propositions for his own existence, the things existed. And what he noticed was that any kind of logic or any kind of assertion or axiom or presumption about existence could be doubted. Right? He could doubt anything. But at the end of the day, he could not doubt that he was doubting. See? So that was for him the fundamental proof. I doubt, therefore I know I am. That's what it really means. Which is a way of realizing that anything can be doubted. That's the thing that's very corrosive about doubt. Anything can be doubted. There's always, you always need more evidence. You can always ask another question. You know, think about young academics, young assistant professors who make their bones, you know, doubting some research that's already been done. Anything can be doubted. It's easy to doubt. So those are the five hindrances. And they are listed in the fourth foundation of mindfulness because the Buddha recommends that we be mindful of them, that we be aware of when they arise, when they color the mind, like a shade or a tint in the paint of the mind. And we are to be aware of what causes them to arise and what causes them to pass away. Any questions or comments so far? Okay. I don't know, and I've wondered exactly that. I think it's maybe when you're remorseful where you get restless, you feel unsettled, you can't set, you know, it's, you're just agitated, you gotta keep it. Other than that, I don't know. There might be some interesting neurological overlap between the two. I don't know. If you have notions about that, maybe there are traditional connections that I don't know about. Yeah. Yeah, maybe that. that too. Yeah, movement away. I think of Erik Erikson, the great psychoanalyst, his theory of adult development. In the first, maybe it's the second stage, is this alternative between shame and worth. And his definition of shame is that which should be hidden is revealed. So in a psychoanalytic way, it's a lot about toilet training and stuff like that. But again, building on what you're saying there, yeah, if we feel ashamed, we want to hide, we want to cover, we want to wrap it open. Okay. Yeah. So how does that relate to restlessness? Are you making that connection there? Good question. Yeah, that makes us restless. Mm-hmm. Any other? Yeah. Yeah, sure. And your mother, too. Don't forget mom or dad. Take your pick, you know. Yeah, it's just, it's all their fault. That's it. A couple things there. So first, you're right about craving. Craving is seen as, it could be valenced either way. So craving for or craving not. You know, craving for the carrot or craving not the stick. Both are craving. So hatred is a form of craving, greed is a form of craving. That's the way it's seen. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So point number one, craving, thirst, it's applied both ways. Interestingly, to your point about the importance of recognizing the craving embedded in aversion, is that the Buddha put a lot of emphasis on aversion. For example, in wise intention, two out of three aspects of wise intention have to do with aversion, have to do with the hatred, dealing with the unpleasant. He really put a lot of emphasis on how we get reactive around the unpleasant. In other words, of the three elements of wise intention, it's been striking that the one is renunciation. So it's the intention for renunciation. Okay, then we get a grip on our greed, the chasing after the pleasant. Good. But then the other two are non-harming, and we harm out of aversion, usually. Once in a while, we harm out of pursuing excessively the pleasant, but typically we harm out of aversion. We're angry at it, or we're afraid of it. Sort of harm. The other one under the heading of wise intention is non-ill will, the intention for not having ill will, not carrying grudges against others, not sustaining a case against others, not being angry at others or wishing them harm, not taking pleasure in their pain. So, and that makes sense to me when I think about the negativity bias of the brain and the degree to which we get caught up in reacting to the unpleasant feeling pain. It was a very dominant thing. Now, it's also true that the Buddha talked about getting really involved in what's pleasant, that too. And some people, I've talked with Andy Alinsky, a teacher at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies in the U.S., near Boston, and he talked about how, for him, it just seems like if there's something negative, you know it's negative and you recognize it, it's hard to proliferate around that. Exactly. I thought, Andy, you're like a Mr. Positivity, dude. Whereas it's like you think about something you want, like I want that cashmere sweater, and how can I get it? It's on sale. Should I do layaway? Do I want to tell my partner? Maybe I could hand for my birthday. And you kind of get into it. But is it still available in the rust tone that I really like? It goes through my skin. And it's 20% off, but that's nothing really at the Gap. I want to wait till it's 50% off, and then I can get a 10% extra if I buy the credit. Yeah, that's how, so he talks about how you kind of proliferate around the pleasant. But Yeah, exactly. I think it can go both ways. And one of the things that I've taken away from the neuro piece is to really do not underestimate the dark side of the force. Really appreciate the power of negativity, which is to me what you're bringing up here, and the proliferation around that. Second question about temperament. Yeah, it does seem that some children are just constitutionally born with a wariness. They're cautious, they're wary. They're prone toward fear. It also seems that some kids are naturally kind of aggressive in their nature, each of which is a kind of aversion. One form is get away from it, the other form is pound on it, but they're both a kind of aversion. It also seems that some kids have a temperament where they're very sunny in their disposition. And they tend to approach things in a benign way. But it can also be the case that some people in general, seem to be quite acquisitive. They have this dwarf-like desire to hoard, to possess, to gather, and don't touch my toys or I'll kill you, like that, right? So there does seem to be some kind of quality of temperament. Our daughter is just innately very sensitive to the unpleasant. And I think that's just a temperamental quality people have. Other people, for example, are very addictive in their brain's physiology. They get that molecule once, they crave it forever. Right? They may be able to sustain a sobriety for a lifespan, but they wake up every morning, wanting a drink. And they'll tell you. And they haven't had them for 20 years, and they wake up every morning wanting a drink. Yeah. So there is a fair amount of biology around this. And to me, the takeaway about that is to recognize one's vulnerabilities and not be ashamed of them, but to see them as nature. It's just nature. Ajahn Chah has a nice story about that. Ajahn Chah is a teacher in this lineage I've described. And in the setting in Thailand, where there are all these animals in the tropics running in and out of people's homes, he's quite funny, actually, too, as well. He's just sort of thinking out loud and talking about and kind of joking about villagers who come to him and they're angry about the monkeys. I just imagine as an American guy living north of San Francisco, monkey. In my house, yeah, the monkeys come in, they steal the pies, makes me so mad, And Ajahn Chah is like, well, close the window. That's what monkeys do. Monkeys are monkeys. And then he goes further, people get mad about the mind. It's what monkeys do, right? So I think there's a place for a kind of compassion about nature. And then we work with it, but we hold it in spaciousness and we have compassion about it. Another kind of story related to that there is a similar quality was told by a teacher of mine, Kamala Masters, who is in Hawaii with her husband, Steve Armstrong. And Kamala and Steve are great. If you have a chance to ever do something with them. Kamala was a student of Manindra. A recent book came out about Manindra, really quite a very refined, great teacher from India. And Kamala's story is that She was traveling with Mahindra in India with a couple of other women who were sort of attendants of his. So the four of them were traveling together. And they traveled to northern India up in the mountains. And at a certain time, they needed to get back to the airport in a major city. I forget what. Okay. And so they went through this fairly detailed and careful process, Kamala did, to find a car with a driver for Mahindra to get him to the airport. I've never been to India, but by all accounts, transportation there can be fairly dramatic and adventurous. So they wanted to get a really honest person with an honest face, with a reliable car. So finally, they found that person and were get ready to go. So they get in the car, and they start heading toward the airport, which is a multi-hour drive. And Kamala notices that there's another fellow sitting in the front seat next to their driver, who they have no idea who this guy is. And of course, she's a cautious person, probably aversively anxious, a little in her own temperament, and she's very protective. Manindra's a saint, basically. Manindra should protect her great teacher, the saint being. And after a while, she taps Mahindra on the shoulder and says, "Mahindra, who is this?" And he says, "Oh, it's the driver's friend." And she taps him again, "Why is he in the car?" And Mahindra looks at her and says, "Well, the driver doesn't know the way." And he does. I'm like, okay. Mahindra shrugs, shakes his head, goes, "This is India." Okay, fine. So then about an hour later, they're going downhill, and she notices that unlike most Indian drivers, the driver's not going, you know, crazy like a bat out of hell. They're going downhill in a very sedate way. And after a while, she taps Mahindra on the shoulder and says, "Why are we going downhill so slowly?" He turns to her and says, "No gas. We're just coasting." She's horrified. She goes, "India." So I think, you know, this is India. The mind is India. You know, it's wild. It's a jungle. It's animal. It's nature. That's what monkeys do. You know, that's what India does. After I heard that story, I would just kind of joke with my family, you know, something would happen, and we kind of shrugged. And, this is India. You know, there's India everywhere. All right. So there's a kind of accepting quality to, you know, the material in the mind. Maybe one more, and then I'll do a little practice with you. That's very nice. Thank you. Great. To the good question. Yeah. So, okay. And then I'll definitely go into a practice. Yeah. I might have a small answer. Do you have a distinction between the two? I think a couple of things. So the question being, you know, what's the distinction between healthy skepticism, not knowing, holding things very provisionally, and doubt that is a hindrance. And I think one is, what's the function that's served? So in great doubt, as it were, we are wholehearted in our engagement with life. And we don't know, or we're not so sure, or we're really examining something. In a context in which we have a wholehearted engagement with life. Problematic doubt, where the function always follow the money. Who benefits? Cui bene? You know that Latin phrase, who benefits? What's the function? What master is served? So if the function, the function of problematic doubt is to detach us from life, step us back. So if in the back of the mind is a fear of committing oneself, you know, just in general, and that's what's really driving the doubt, then that's a sign, that's a clue that there's something problematic in the doubt. Second is, does it just seem to go on past the point of usefulness? In other words, is it repetitive? Do we just keep looping over and over? How do I know my partner loves me? She's nice to me, but how do I know that she's not tricking me? You know, just I think that's a clue to me that I kind of doubt. I think that if there's a frame of confidence and well-being in the Buddha's gesture of touching the earth, I belong here, I get to be here, I don't doubt that I get to be here, I'm claiming my place. And inside that, there's not knowing and mystery and wonder and curiosity. To me, that feels like great doubt, good doubt. You know? But when there's an emotional tone of unsettledness and partiality and endlessly reserving a wholehearted engagement or commitment, I think that's problematic. Yeah, that's right. Maybe there's a sense of inadequacy in oneself that leads to that doubt. I think that's a great inquiry for you. You know, what, like in my own psych, and it helps to understand one's psychology. You know, in my own psychology, I don't know if you know the Enneagram. The Enneagram's a nice model. Yeah. Of all the models I've encountered as a psychologist, I think it's the best one. And on a good day, it might describe barely 50% of a person. So you got to take a little grain of salt. And I think some people are not well described by it. Some people are. There are 9 personality types. And there's some complication in it where you partake of both one or another, depending on stress or relaxation, all that. Myself, as a giveaway, a social 7. So now you know half of my psychology in a nutshell. You know, there's a tendency in this particular personality type to want to preserve all options. The kind of person that has a hard time with a menu in a restaurant because they want one from every column, you know? And they want to keep everything in the air. You know, a decision, the root of the word decision is dakido, to kill off the alternative. You know, that personality type doesn't want to kill off any possibilities. Doesn't, you know? The problem, though, is with that psychology, it's really every commitment is provisional and tentative. And there's a tendency to continually be looking outside the window for the other option and jumping ship, assuming something else looks better. And so, and that tends to drive doubt. I mean, there's a doubting of these various things. That was a lot my psychology, and a key time for me toward my late 20s when I learned about this system and I had some soul searching to do, and I realized, you know, the ways that my character type applied to me. No one's flattered, by the way, in the Enneagram. There are no good, the 9 types, none of them are good, in a sense. You know, so they're all humbling. And anyway, so when I saw that, I realized that I'd never gone all in one thing. You know, because I'd always wanted to preserve my other options. And so that would be an example of your psychology being a factor in the hindrance system. It's enough? Okay. Good. Well, that's valuable. I appreciate that. Thank you. want to try a practice? So, bringing it into experience. What I would ask you to do is to pick something, first of all, that you have aversion related to, that's real for you. Some situation in your life today, or some risk, or maybe just an ongoing kind of trait anxiety, trait being a stable quality, or maybe just trait irritability. Some people are, you know, fairly quick to push against. Okay? Maybe think of someone, and as soon as you think of them, you really have to practice to not get aggravated. Okay? And if all else fails, you can pick a political leader that you don't care for. I've done things at Spirit Rock, you know, where everybody's loving and New Age and Marin County and doing loving kindness for everyone and it's all going great. And I say, how about Dick Cheney? You know, so whatever, we could go the other way, you know. Other people might say, how about Hillary Clinton or whatever. So, okay, so bring to mind the situation. And don't harm yourself here, you know, don't go into some, you know, traumatic place. Be gentle with this. That said, if you could, deliberately kind of trigger yourself as a bit of an experiment around fear or anger or both, various aspects of aversion, various aspects of hatred, the second hindrance. And then as you do that, and I'll be quiet for a few minutes here, I just encourage you to do this on your own, as soon as you can kind of activate in your body an experience, which may well include emotions, attitudes, beliefs, whatever. In other words, there's a kind of gristly nugget of aversion. Then go into that nugget and see if you can tease apart some of its elements. What are the body sensations, for example? What are the attitudes? What are the emotions? You know, what are the thoughts? What are the memories? What are the elements of it, the constituents of this aversion? And in each one of those elements, ask yourself and inquire, is there self here? And if it's true for you, you might explore, you know, there is tension, there is anger, there is fear. And if it's true for you, you might softly say in your mind, there is no self in this sensation. There is no self in this plane. There is no self in this grievance, if that's true for you. So I'll be quiet for a few minutes now. about this. In general, notice what happens to this upset as you tease apart its threads. And also observe those threads in a less personal, more allocentric way, as in there is tension. There is something in the pit of the stomach. There is the desire for vengeance. What happens? What happens to the amount of suffering in the upset? What did you notice? Got sucked in? Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes it can help to pick something even milder. If it's too much, pick something milder and milder and milder. Maybe even a memory of a trivial thing that happened 30 years ago. What? Yeah, okay. Ah. Really? Okay. Maybe I could have. No. I'm thinking, gee, maybe I did it wrong. If you're gonna, Jan, did you? Andrew, you said you could look at the elements of the reaction. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, what happened then? Okay, so that part, yeah, that was the intended aim. But maybe we could have taken more time with it too, to have time to pull apart the elements. How about other people? What happened when you tried to pull apart the elements? Yeah. Wow. Okay. So right there is kind of, this is India, right? Just right there. It was 3.5 minutes, 4 minutes, right there. So, I think that's totally true. Yeah. It can help to talk the elements through with somebody. That's for sure true. I think it's also true that it's possible to hold oneself to the practice that says, look, I'm just going to inquire into what are the body sensations of this upset. And there are several different ones. You know, they're different, right? And then, okay. You know, anyway, so I think both things are true. It's very helpful to me to do this with others. Therapy's good. And so are conversations around a campfire and walks with friends and good partners and dogs and talking to your dog. I know people that talk to the dog. They get a lot of value, and the dog never charges for the session. You know. Okay. Good. Yeah. Yeah. Nothing terribly original. Yeah, you know, sometimes those two things you've described, writing it down, talking to the tape recorder, talking with a friend, a therapist, sometimes writing a letter that you know you never send, including writing that letter with various variations, like writing the angry letter and then writing the sad letter that really is underneath the angry letter. You know, and then writing the wise letter that kind of sorts it all through at the end, and then doing what you do with them. Maybe send the wise letter, maybe don't. Another powerful thing is to imagine a being. Could be a person from one's life previously, like a lovely grandparent or something, or maybe a some kind of being of light one imagines, you know, and then going to that being and then talking, telling that being about it all. And then being open to what that being has to say. And maybe even the being offers some kind of object or something as a real symbol of the teaching that you take with you coming back. I think those are different helpful things. Okay. Yeah, Jess. Okay, good, thank you. No, really, great. Did you? Yeah, please. Yeah, I see. Well, let me apologize, first of all. I didn't quite realize that it would grab you so much, you know. But really, I don't think it was skillful on my part. I should have set that up more. So sorry about that. And still, I would encourage you to pursue the Buddhist wisdom about teasing apart the elements of experiences, you know, disaggregating them. What are the barest facts? You know, what's the feeling tone? What are our various labels or attributions or appraisals we put on it, our various perceptions? What does this remind us of, you know, this childhood material? What earlier similar upsets get, you know, the stack gets pulled, ding, 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 ding. That's perception. And then what's there in the mental formations about this upset, all the thoughts, you know, the various other emotions about it, plans, how this lands, you know, the interpretations we put on it, all that, right? But I think that's valuable. And I think when we do that, the Buddhist metaphor, interestingly, one of the main metaphors for self is a banana tree. Because as you go into a banana tree and you look for the core, you just keep unwrapping it, and there's no core to be found. You know, I'd never thought of it, but that image last night of the portrait on a tapestry looks like an entity there, but when you tease it apart, you just have pigmented threads. Dialing it down to the point that it doesn't suck you in, taking your time with it. The general strategy of teasing apart the elements in our aversive reactions to things or our greedy grasping reactions to things, as well as in the other three hindrances, is a good core strategy. Obviously, you know, have more respect for the dark side of the force than I had when I did this with you. You know, take your time, set yourself up well, and get some distance from it. But it's a good strategy. Yeah. To go into an upset? Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I don't think so. But I think sometimes, honestly, for some people, me included, there you are, you're meditating, and something comes up that's been on your mind. Maybe because your mind's quiet now, it can bubble up, or it's there, it's tugging at you. And I think sometimes if you cannot get sucked into it, you can spend a productive 5, 10, 20 minutes just kind of processing that thing, but in this much more meditative place, this much more open, unpacking place. You know, then you're not strictly training concentration or something else, but you're definitely getting value and you're reducing your suffering. So to me, it's a means to that end. Just to beware the tendency to use meditation as your own personal therapy, you know, as other purposes than that. But that would be an example. But to I wouldn't propose that one routinely use meditation to cultivate non-aversion. You know. Ways to cultivate non-aversion, especially around anxiety, maybe I'll mention a few of those that I've seen. One is to not privilege anxiety. The brain hyper-privileges anxiety. It's the original emotion. It's the first emotion. You think about it, it's the most primal emotion, anxiety. The very first thing our ancestors had to learn how to do was to fear, because they had to, you know, not be lunch today. So the brain privileges anxiety. Anything we're afraid of tends to trump everything else. It pushes everything else aside. So one of the things a person can do is you can just simply observe, you know, it's just anxiety. It doesn't mean there's anything to be afraid of. It's just anxiety. kind of relate to it. It's just like a body sensation. It's just anxiety. Don't relate to it as meaningful. Don't relate to it as compelling or having any inherent power. It's just one more piece of information on the table to be evaluated. That's powerful right there. You know, and grounded in an understanding of, you know, evolutionary neuropsychology. A second thing I think is very important is the invocation of allies. In other words, calling forth the felt sense of allies with us, those who care about us, our protectors. It's said even symbolically in the Buddha's own awakening that allies came to him for helping deal with Mara. You know, the image or reality of delusion and evil. I think I quoted, did I not, the saying from AA, the mind is a dangerous neighborhood, never go in alone. You know, we want to have allies with us. So that's, to me, that's a very important thing. And to have the humility to realize that we need allies. We need forces with us. I think one more thing I'll just say about anxiety that I've seen a lot is to make a plan to deal with it. Yeah. Whatever is reasonable in the anxiety, make a plan. I know people who are anxious about things, and they'll tell you they're anxious. Hey, doc, I'm worried about this lump in my shoulder. Wow, you should go see a physician about that. Yeah. We come back a week later. Well, I'm really worried about this lump on my shoulder. Oh, did you see a physician about that? No. You know, they didn't take action. I'm really worried about losing my job. You know, I keep coming in late. A week later, how are you doing with coming in on time to your job? Nah, I'm still coming in late all the time. No wonder they're worried, right? You know, Dad, I'm afraid I'm going to get a, you know, bad grade in my course. Oh, how come? You know, I'm not getting to my paper. I'm not writing my term paper. Oh, okay. A week later, how are you doing? Oh, boy, I'm really worried about my grade in the course. Make any headway with your paper? Nah, I was playing video games. You know, so that's another one. And there's a kind of tough-mindedness to that. A lot of people don't take action. Take up arms. You know, take action. And then when you've taken all the action you can, as, again, Ajahn Chah said, you know, tend to the causes. You cannot control the results. That's all you can do, is tend to the causes. Do what you can. I think of the quote from this beautiful boy in South Africa who was HIV positive at birth. His mother was a prostitute, and he had HIV at birth, and he died when he was about 12. But before he died, he became a symbol in South Africa of this sort of shame of the country that they tried to push off stage, and yet he and others really stood up and said, "Philly for children, no, you need to see us, we're real." The numbers are staggering. The percentages in South Africa that are HIV positive are just astonishing. Nkosi Johnson was his name, and he had a lovely saying, to paraphrase it. He said, you know, do what you can with what you've been given in the place where you are in the time that you have. Here, this little 10-year-old, 12-year-old kid could say that. You know, who am I to not listen? We do what we can, and then we move on. You know, we don't need to be anxious anymore. We've done what we could. What will happen will happen. We've tended to the causes. We cannot control the result. You know, we can water the fruit tree, but we can't make it give us an apple. And peace. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could look it up on Wikipedia, the exact phrasing, you know, but what I remember of it, it's these four elements to it. It basically says, do what you can with what you've been given in the place where you are in the time that you have. Okay, one more, then we really should move on. Yeah.
This goes back to yesterday's talk. Do you
want it? Maybe you could name it, and then I'll think about it.
You said say about three things. There's mindfulness, there's the planting of flowers, and you've got an example of how that can be done practically, but there's also the choosing a way. And I don't think I don't have any sense of what that would actually involve in terms of the practice.
You mean the letting go phase,
yeah.
The sweeping away, as a practice?
When I was a child, I used to steal all the time. I haven't stolen for decades, but as soon as I passed the diner box, I thought, I can steal the money out of that. No idea. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Take it out of his box, not mine. Few things, really come quickly. I'll take my cue from the Buddha's discussion of wise effort. And he talks about three movements, if you will. One is to prevent it in the first place. So maybe you shouldn't walk out that door. You should, I'm joking, but you know what I mean? Prevent it in the first place. There's a nice saying, guard the sense doors. You know, if you have an excessive predilection toward drink, don't have it in your house. If you tend to overeat, don't keep big boxes of cookies at home. Guard the sense doors. Resolve. I'm not going to do that. Make promises to other people. Prevent it in the first place. That's a kind of letting go. You know, we diminish the unwholesome. We diminish the possibility of weeds. The second thing is to decrease it. If it's there, do harm reduction. So if you're going to do something that's problematic, you know, try to bound it. Don't drink too much. Don't eat too much. Don't steal too much. Whatever, you know. Not that you do, I know. Harm reduction, reduce it. So, for example, if you tend to, you know, think about yelling at the kids or yelling at your partner or just being bristly or angry or snappish or grouchy, do less of it. For example, when you get home, take 10 minutes, sit outside, calm down, let some of the stress of the day diminish. So when you walk in the front door and it's showtime, you're ready to go as a parent, let's say, or a partner. Reduce it. That's good. And the third is, if it's present, destroy it, end it, stop it, don't do it. Throw the booze away, get rid of the dope, get rid of all those old Penthouse magazines, whatever. You know, get rid of the Land's End catalogs. I don't know. I see. Wait a second. Okay. It's whatever, you know, catalog companies, shopping catalogs, you know. If you go into the grocery store and you've been walking down the baked goods aisles and you're throwing the donuts in, you know, get them out, whatever it is, you know, just get rid of it, including get that thought out of your head. Just pew. And the trick, of course, is not to get too aversive about it, angry with yourself about it. There's a certain, no way, Jose. So I think that would be, I'll do it like that. I'll leave it right there. I think of in Hinduism, to wrap up on this point, the notion of the divine coming in three forms, as you probably know. The creator, the preserver, the destroyer. And it's quite remarkable to think of, you know, imagining God or maybe some just wholesome process in the universe that has to do with things ending, completing, ending. We stop. We don't do it. We stop. There's a certain amount of the teachings in the Dharma that I've read that I recall that have to do with just stop. Oh, I'll finish on this one. You know the story of Angulimala? It's a very dramatic story from the Dharma. Angulimala, let's see, Anguli, I guess, is a finger. And Angulimala was a serial killer who had a mala, a necklace, of the fingers of his victims. I mean, he had enough fingers that he could make a necklace out of them. And he decided to kill the Buddha. And apparently there's some historical truth to this, because there's some detail in the story. And so he tries to track down the Buddha. The way the sutta reads is that he found the Buddha who was on alms round, and Angulimala chased after the Buddha to get him and kill him. And the Buddha did not speed up, but somehow he was always ahead of Angulimala. Angulimala could never get him. And finally Angulimala called out and said, "Stop." And the Buddha turned around and said, "I've stopped, Angulimala. Have you?" Angulimala had a mini awakening on the spot and decided to become a renunciate. And he became a major devotee student of the Buddha. And as the story concludes, further things happened, including Angulimala came to the Buddha one time and complained to him and said, "You know, the villagers shout at me and yell at me and hit me and curse me. You're lucky they don't. I'm going to a pit of boiling oil, dude." But anyway, and the Buddha said, "Yeah, but you must bear that. That's your karma. You must bear that." But even someone who's a serial killer, this is quite touching, could be included by the Buddha as someone who could practice and who achieved a very high level of awakening, supposedly, in his own lifetime. But my point here, to finish as we go on to the next phase, is the notion of I've stopped. The Buddha said, "I've stopped. I've stopped craving. I've stopped feeding the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. I've stopped drinking of the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. I've stopped. You know, I've seen the futility of the whole business. I've stopped. Have you?" And think about that for myself and for us. You know, what is there to stop? You know, anxious preoccupations, you know, angry ruminations, self-criticism, unwholesome pursuits. But he says, "I've stopped. You know, have you? I better stop. I'm going." Yeah, I think it could be that, but it doesn't need to be that. You know, I've stopped certain things where I realized, you know, there's often the last time we ever do it, right? There is a last time. There's the last time we ever hit a child. You know, I'm willing to say, like most parents, not all, I've spanked my kids, but on really very minimal and on the fingers of one hand, less than all the fingers. But each time when I look back, when I could have handled it better. And I stopped. Just not doing that again. You know, I've known people who just stopped drinking or stopped using drugs. They were stopped. Maybe they cheated on their partner and big process around it, maybe a reconciliation. They stopped.
I was asking about stopping drinking and then wanting to think, God, and then stopping drinking. Stop. That's not the problem. The problem is that impulse.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think part of it is to stop doing it and you know, and stop feeding it, because the more we do it, the more the brain wants it. That's part one. Another part is to pull the roots. You know, like in my case, I realized that part of what was driving that parental SWAT was anger. And realizing that helped uproot it. I had a different kind of I think sometimes we The truth is, I think for some desires, we stop acting them out, but we can't stop them arising. Maybe we're just animal, you know, we're just hardwired. But I think in other cases, we truly do stop the desire. We're done with it. You know, or we stop that way of thinking about things. You know, we think a new way. I had a, just thinking of this example, in my 20s, an insight that I had in school been a nerd, not a wimp. I stopped thinking of myself as a wimp, this wussy little putz of a kid, because I really wasn't. And I was done with that way of looking at myself. I was stuck. You know, stopped in lots of ways. I think the opportunity of the Buddha is that the Buddha offered basically is to stop thinking that craving will make us happy. Okay, let's stop. So we're 10 minutes late for my little cycle here, but we'll do interviews and you guys will be back on track. Okay, good.